Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the following restaurants for supporting No Goat Left Behind: Vinegar Hill House, Purple Yam, and Roberta's. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a recent and new episode of Unfiltered. It seems like it's been forever since we've been on air. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Brian. Yes, it has been quite some time.
Well, as you guys probably know, this is your host, Brian DeMarco, with the lovely and talented Aaron Fitzpatrick, and of course, the ever multi-talented Lucy Liu here in the back. Taping us and cheering us on with some lovely 6-point beer straight from Roberta's here.
Yep.
And I'm happy to be back at the cave here. This is nice.
There's definitely been some upgrades. Not only has there been a new Heritage Radio Network website that's been launched, all the team here has been really working hard on that. Yep, Jack, Carlos, and now we got a nice cozy lounge with some good amber mood lighting too. So
I like this. This is I like the single light bulb effect too sometimes. But I was just informed by our producer Jack that someone won a prize at the MOFAD event we were at recently.
Yes,
and that it was to a day with the producers.
Oh, cool.
So, Jack, you hear me. And it's someone won, actually bid on, I think it was it was $24, Jack?
Well, that was a starting bid. Let's talk about the closing.
Yeah.
The
I think it was a few hundred dollars to come in and
they get some money for it. Yeah,
the studio and be Jack's plebe for the day.
They get to choose the music and hang out in the booth. And
Nice.
Unfortunately, they didn't take my recommendation of making it a female-only bidding thing.
Oh, shoot. But, yeah. You single ladies out there.
I thought it was a date with the
producers. Stop by
the
studio. Yeah. So for our listeners who don't know, MOFAD is the Museum of Food and Drink, which is a really exciting project that's going to be launching in New York City, spearheaded by Patrick Martins and Dave Arnold.
Our fearless leader, Patrick Martins.
And all about sort of the history of food, the science of it. In a place like New York, there's probably not a better city to do that with so many different ethnicities and culture of food here. So not exactly sure where that space is going to be, nor do I think that they know, but it's definitely a space to watch. And
let's call it a virtual museum right now. But I think it's exciting stuff, and it really kind of illustrates that this movement that we talk about, and whether it's in food and wine or in agro stuff, is really sort of taking hold, and people really start to realize and recognize where their food is coming from, and hopefully where their wine is being made, and how wine is an agro product. And it's funny because you were just reading to me an article that came through in this last weekend's FT by Jancis Robinson. And it really talks about the Champagne vintage being a really anomaly. Why don't you elaborate on that, Aaron?
Well, I think 2011 overall was a challenging year for a lot of growers in agriculture. So obviously, closest to us here in New York, the upstate farms were drastically hit. And out in Long Island, though the damage wasn't as bad, just the intense rain has really caused a lot of rot, not only for vegetables like pumpkins and things out there, lettuces, but for the wine growers, it's been a really tough year. So the article that Jancis wrote, it was just talking about, how no one could forecast what this vintage was, and it really sort of brings back to wine as an agricultural product, which is sometimes, I think, forgotten. And 2009, 2010 were such good vintages. This one has really thrown the growers for a loop, and that's kind of worldwide, actually.
It's interesting because I think a lot of people, when they see wine on the shelf, especially in a grocery store, they perceive it as, you know, almost like they would beer or vodka, where it's this consistency, and there's, you know, it comes at a certain price, and only truly do some collectors and some drinkers know that vintage makes a huge difference. And mm-hmm. and so as we get better and better at making wine, and there's less and less vintage variation, we tend to take for granted that wine is still an agro product, and that, you know, for example, when we were having our hurricane here in New York, who would have thought that Vermont would have got hit the worst based on Mother Nature and the devastation it did there, when a place like Miami is completely ready for these things. And Vermont, you know, if worse is worried about a snowstorm. And conversely, I remember being here battening down the hatches for the hurricane, and I was getting a call from a good friend of the show, Justin Christoph, and he was in the Mosul, and they were getting hail the size of golf balls. And it probably has made two or three of the premier crew Appalachians up there almost devastated. I mean, this half their crop is gone. And, you know, I remember that you had just recently come back from Champagne,
yeah,
right? And
yep.
So what did you notice there? Has there any been?
Well, it was the earliest vintage on record, really, since 1822, which is wild. There, 2003 was also, you know, quite a hot year. So that
was 1822. What's reference are you making?
Just in terms of, you know, the picking, the earliest date of picking.
The earliest date of picking this mm-hmm. year for 2011
since
1822.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and in this article that Jancis writes, you know, she talks about, you know, the grape skins usually softening and starting to change color in August, and that's a process known as veraison, but that started happening as early as the end of June, sort of in most of Europe. But
so what do you think happens with the ripeness? Because that doesn't it need some hang time? And
it does. I mean, came out of the trip, because we were scheduled to go in September, and that was... it was picked that date because it was going to be prior to harvest. So we ended up arriving in the middle of harvest, which is always a crazy time for wine growers. And we were visiting their chateau, and a lot of the growers in different parts of Champagne were affected differently, because the Chardonnay grapes were doing or faring a lot better than the red grapes. The Pinot Noir and the Pinot Meunier were more susceptible to rot. And the Chardonnay was faring better. So we did go to a grower, and I had a little interview that I took with him just about, you know, where he was at in the vintage and how things were looking for them. And because so much of the percentage of their blend in their wines was Chardonnay, you know, they were doing okay. But for those growers that where Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier is a larger percentage, mm-hmm. It was going to be a tougher year for them. So I think we'll actually play a little interview that I did with one of the marketing managers at one of the vineyards that we... Well,
why don't you set it up for me? Tell me, like, what was your reason for being there? And then...
Sure.
And then sort of like when, you know, don't spoil the punchline, but like, I'm dying to understand, you know, what your net takeaways were. So yeah, we can talk about that afterwards.
Sure. Yeah. Net takeaways, just to sort of lead into this, was that so many of the, we've visited, this was a trip, I'll start from the very beginning. This is a trip organized by the Center for Wine Origins, which is based in Washington, D.C. And their main goal is to protect place names such as Champagne and Porto and Jerez. Well, these are their main sort of people who've signed on to protect place of origin for where these wine regions have started. And so Champagne, Porto, Jerez, hugely historical in their in wine.
And significance being that in the 70s, because of the popularity of some of these place names, that California producers felt and took liberties in calling sparkling wine from California Champagne, mm-hmm. calling Chardonnay, you know, Flinty Chardonnay, Chablis, and vice versa. There was a big backlash from especially French producers who said, you can't use our place names. Right. And so now there's actually an official group that monitors this. Is that what you're telling me?
And Champagne is, I'd say, one of the more regulated wine regions in the world. But there's a Committee for Viticulture of Champagne, the CAVC, which oversees all of those regulations. But then there's also the Center for Wine Origins, which is solely devoted to making consumers aware of where their origins of these particular regions fall, and then also people in the trade and journalists making them sort of educated as to how to feed that that education off to the consumer.
So they sponsor the trip.
They sponsor the trip.
And
yeah.
So you're over there and mm-hmm. you're hanging out and
and they
drinking champagne.
And drinking champagne at every meal. Had an amazing opportunity to sit with winemakers at Jexon, Bruno Payard, and this other winery, small grower called Penne Chardonnay. A couple nights we had dinner at their houses, and they were bringing out different older vintages, a lot of them which were out of Magnum, which was a complete treat. But the opportunity to sit with winemakers over a course of a dinner who have a completely different sort of philosophy as to how to make their wine.
They also probably have a completely different worldview.
Yeah, well, that too, yeah. it was very interesting to have the scale within such a small region as Champagne. And given that there's so many growers there, it's really the Champagne houses that produce the majority of the wine in the region. So a lot of these growers are either selling some of their grapes and bottling a small amount on their own. But the Champagne houses is what, I'd say the majority of the consumers know about.
Sure.
The Moët and the Veuves and those guys, the Nicolas Feuillet. So we went to some larger places to visit, as well as some of the smaller growers. And
what struck you the most, obviously beyond the scale and the money involved?
Yeah.
What struck you most, the attitudes or the way that you were perceived or received, I should say, from the big houses to the small growers?
Well, I'd say the majority of the, we did visit mostly with smaller growers, which was a real treat. So we did, Jackson, Didier, Gimonet, and then Penne Chardonnay. The biggest one we went to was the Nicolas Feuillet, which was, similar in a way when I went to visit a sherry sort of larger cooperative. And you see it more on a factory level, and just, even though they do commit themselves to working hand in hand with the growers over many, many years to establish those relationships, there is a little bit of a romance that's certainly taken out of that equation, but that's the business of it. So there wasn't any, I'd say, large revelations per se. It was just really interesting to hear about people's philosophy with respect to blending the different grapes. Mm-hmm. So and the terroir that comes along with that. So
so the tape we're about to hear is an interview with whom again?
This is from a winery that we visited called Penne Chardonnay, which is it's not spelled as N-N-A-Y, as in Chardonnay the grape. It's spelled D-O-N-E-T, or D-O-N-N-E-T. They have a predominant amount of Chardonnay in their blends. And they definitely like more of a roundy, broodier style, a fuller mm-hmm. style. So we are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we will lead into this clip.
Great. Well, I can't wait to hear.
Green-eyed lady, lovely lady, strolling slowly towards the sun. Green-eyed lady, ocean lady, soothing air. every raging wave that comes. Green-eyed lady, passion's lady, dressed in love, she lives for life to be. Green-eyed lady feels like I never see setting suns and lonely lovers free.
Welcome back to Unfiltered with your co-host Aaron Fitzpatrick and
Brian DeMarco.
Yeah, good selection on a tune for this afternoon, Brian. So we are speaking today about the 2011 vintage growing season, as well as just a recap of a trip I recently went on with the Center for Wine Origins to Champaign. And we're gonna play a clip that I interviewed one of the very young, I think he was about 19 years old, but a manager for the brand Panay Chardonnay, which is a small champagne house specializing in non-dosage, so very sort of dry style. That's their philosophy, and they mature their wines, even non-vintage, for a minimum of 5 years on lees before disgorging them. So they have a long history of that, and a non-dosage champagne is either labeled as a extra brut or a brut nature style, which it was something that seemed like the houses that we visited had been experimenting with, or at least, you know, there'd been a growth in the marketing of non-dosage wines in the past 5 years. People are interested in a dry style of bubbles, and that certainly is something that goes really well with food. So we will play that clip, Jack, if you can. So we've just finished a tour at Panay Chardonnay with Adrian Asoulin, who is the sales and export manager for the winery here. Thanks so much for the tour.
You're welcome.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but the winery has about five generations, and you said it began in 1901?
Yeah, right. Completely. So we are a company that exists since five generation, but 1908 wine. Actually, we are working in a traditional way, and we are trying to find the compromise between the tradition and the modern way to evolve mm-hmm. in the new market.
And how do you feel, I mean, given the sort of spike in 2007 with respect to export sales and then a little bit of a drop since the economy crashed in 2008, you know, where you stand as a smaller grower producer within the whole scope of the industry now?
Actually, it was quite difficult to go through the crisis. But for little wine grower like us, we can't really feel this kind of crisis, you know. It's more for the big houses. So we try to just get out the mass and to distinguish ourselves doing export since 2009 mm-hmm. more, and increasing export because this is one of the way to get out of the crisis. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that there's a bit of a tug of war between bottling your own champagne or selling the grapes to other houses more and more, or are you trying to keep more of the production and sales as estate grown and sold?
As the time passed by, we really tried to increase the production, our own production, and to decrease the sales of grapes in general, because of our new strategy. In fact, for sure, this is more convenient and really easy to just sell the grapes and do the work along the year. But if you make your own product and sell it, it's a kind of challenge, really good challenge, and this is so beautiful to sell it on bottle.
Are you in any other markets besides France?
Yeah, for sure. We are increasing the export. So in Europe, in United States, we are beginning to come on this last month, and a bit in Asia, for example.
That's exciting. Any other things about the vintage that you're excited about, or any sort of growth in terms of the winery going forward in this next year?
I guess 2011 will be a really good year. We had a good year also in 2009, so we're excited to see what we'll have in the future years with this kind of your champagnes.
And are there any sort of big obstacles or sort of tensions going on now that we're here in Champagne and we might not hear about some of these things in the United States? Are there any sort of big, I don't want to say fights or battles, but essentially within the growers / maison or houses, unions, are there sort of big issues at hand right now, or is it more calm?
Actually, this is difficult to get out of the mass and to distinguish between the big houses, the little wine grower, and the competition we have between all the little wine grower together. But in Champagne, as this is a really, really small vineyard, we have a lot of competitors, so we have to distinguish, so it's not so cool. For our company, we just try to distinguish as much as possible, doing some really qualitative products, and to try to take the best of the big houses in terms of communication, to make our brand known into the world thanks to the Champagne appellations.
Great. And my last question is, I know you sort of specialize in a low dosage, a very drier style of champagne, and I'm wondering if that's something that you see as a trend in the region, or if that's how your champagne style has always been.
Okay, yeah. Actually, we can see that this is, on the one hand, a trend in the region, because all over the year we've seen the brands, the different brands of the champagne houses and wine growers that are going from the brut or even more dose the champagne to the low dosage champagnes. But for a company, it's a kind of tradition. All the company used to produce low champagne dosage from years and years and generation even, and this is a taste of the family. This is a taste of Alexandre Pernet here, and of all the people present in the company.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and the fantastic tour. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick from Unfiltered, and signing off on the field from Champagne Penny Chardonnay.
In the field.
Cheers.
I love that. Like cub reporter in the field.
On my little handheld Canon device or Olympus device. Yeah.
I love it.
There it is. That's the explanation for the non-dosage. That's from a Penny Chardonnay, which is only about 30,000 bottles or so production per year. So they were lucky. They were lucky in terms of this vintage, in terms of the amount of Chardonnay were not affected by the early picking like some others. But speaking of, how have some of your wineries that you represent at Barter House fared in this year? Any crisis going on with their vintages, or have you heard anything?
I have heard Austria, you know, which is a pretty big topic for us on this show. They've been on a few times, but the 11 vintages looking good, but the 10 vintage, which was very, very hard for everyone, is now creating an incredible shortage of wine for the base Grüner Veltliners, and specifically them trying to grow some Rieslings. You know, Germany will have its own opinion about this, but for us, and at least in my business, we can't provide the same level or the same volume of Grüner Veltliner that we did in 2009 vintage.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean to say that the producers don't, they don't get it in terms of what demand is. The big producers do. For example, Leo Hillinger, who is a friend of the show and a personal friend, he is actually making his domestic market suffer to not sell short in the U.S. because mm-hmm. he realizes that his loyal customers in Austria will stay loyal and that they understand, because the whole region gets that there's a lower vintage, lower bottles made across the board.
Yeah.
So he's holding our allocations and making his home market suffer, where other producers would just say, well, we're just going to export less.
Right.
So I think Austria is wise in the ways of exporting and understands that they're a little player, and if they lose any ground, that it's really, really hard to make it back up.
Sure.
And
yeah.
So we've seen that, and we hope that our customers respect that and get that with limited production comes higher prices.
Sure. Also, something to even kind of put into that mix of economies of scale. When we were in Champagne, it's because there was so much stop and go, you know, they would pick one day and say, oh, we got to pull back because, you know, temperatures were fluctuating so much. The pickers that come in for the harvest are generally there over a course of, you know, depending on the size of the vineyard, a week to a month. And because of the stop and go situation, you had people sort of lingering, which then takes another effect on the winery itself, because if they want to continue to employ the pickers for the harvest, which is all done by hand, mm-hmm. and not have them return to their regular jobs, which they work at the rest of the year.
Or their native countries.
Yeah, they got to figure out how to get them to stick around, which is just one of those other things that I just don't think you really think about until you're actually there and looking at these people who have set up camp on the side of, you know, the fields next to the vineyards, in whether they're tents or trailers.
Well, that's just, it's funny, you know, Julian, who's also a friend of ours, who does Jules Wine in the south of France, you know, he's in a little town called Carnoul, and it's just about 30 kilometers north of Saint-Tropez, but an hour either from the closest airport, it's at least an hour from Cannes or from Nice or whatever, and there's no easy way to get people and ferry people in and out. So it's not like you have day workers who show up,
right?
And you can put them on a bus in some major city and bring them in. So he has Moroccans typically that come in, mm-hmm. and they sleep in tents in the vineyard,
right?
And so and they essentially bring food out for them, mm-hmm. and it's not like they're migrant workers or anything, but they're paid. They're year after year. A lot of these guys, they know everyone on first name basis, and
there's a loyalty there.
They work every harvest, and like you said, when there's some fluctuation in weather or timing, and you can't pick a certain crop, you've got to entertain these people for a few days in a row without them working. So yeah. I know how it takes a toll, especially if harvest goes on past 3 weeks. You're really looking at a stress on the whole system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. And just to close, as that last reference to the article that we opened with in the FT, it was talking about how 2011 will be the master craftsman vintage, because so much of what has gone into this is, you know, how the grapes in the vineyards are going to fare, which is, if they're not doing as great, the person who's making them have to really sort of hone in on their craft too.
Well, I mean, and I think you have these ebb and these flows, because vintages like 05 and 09, it was almost hard for people to make bad wine. If you made bad wine in Bordeaux or the Rhone or even Burgundy in those years, you really were not minding the store.
Right.
And it really goes back to someone's craft. Where you can tell when, say, if you go to a Daniel Boulud restaurant, you know when he's in the kitchen, right?
Sure.
But every Tuesday night, there needs to be a level of consistency and quality that keeps people coming back. And so,
and he does that well.
I'm saying that's so great producers will still make great wine.
Yeah.
In this hard vintage, but
right.
You'll see some of the producers who benefited from the weather, maybe falling short this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'll really, the men from the boys, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, it's been such a great week. I'm glad. I can't believe our time is up already.
Yeah, I know. But, well, we'll have to think of a nice thing to do and sit in here for a little while longer before the next show comes on. So maybe we'll plot out next week's show. Don't get any ideas.
Oh my God. Someone pull the drapes.
Well, thanks everyone for tuning in to Unfiltered. And sorry to have been away from the mic for so long. It feels good to be back.
Feels back in the house. All back right, in thanks, the house. Guys. Take
Congratulations
care.
On Fork and Anchor.
Thank you. Yes, our listeners, that is our business that Lucy Milner and myself have opened up in the East End in East Marion, just below Orient in the North Fork. So being surrounded by the vines on a daily basis kind of couldn't be more dreamy.
Best roast beef sandwich on the North Fork.
Come out and visit. Yep. Fork and Anchor. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following message has been brought to you by Taste Brooklyn. Our city's finest chefs partner with farmers and local vineyards next to the Green Market for an extraordinary outdoor culinary festival. Try exquisite delicacies using locally grown seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Feel to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. This is a public service announcement from Sea to Table and Slow Food NYC.
On October 11th, sustainable seafood distributor Sea to Table will join Slow Food New York City to host an event celebrating the bounty of local New York seafood. The event, Slow You, Sustainable Sashimi, will feature a tasting of four fish species from local Montauk waters. The event will take place on Tuesday, October 11th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Institute of Culinary Education, 50 West 23rd Street in Manhattan. Tickets are $25 for Slow Food members, $35 for non-members. Visit slowfoodnyc.org for more information about this event and how to get tickets.
As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event.